Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As people travel, they take with them their tastes and flavors, and then they marry them with new ones. And so it's something that ties us to our roots, but at the same time, it's also something that allows us to connect with other people. And I think that that's probably what I appreciate the most and what I find the most enriching about studying the history of food.
Hello, my name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome back to another archaeogastronomical adventure. The Islamic Golden Age. What image those words conjure in one's mind? Do you think of the Arabian Nights, or as it should probably called, 1001 Nights? Is your imagination also filled with other Middle Eastern folk tales like the Aladdin and Ali Baba, and Sinbad the Sailor? Is this what comes to one's mind when we're talking about the medieval Arab world? Or maybe the flourishing of scientific, cultural, economic activities in the near Middle East and the center of the world's knowledge in the largest city then, called Baghdad? Well, so you should. These are superbly important aspects of the medieval Arab world. But for me, equally important was the flourishing of an extremely delicious, complex culinary tradition, a cuisine with one foot in the Arab Peninsula and the other in ancient Persia. Mouth-watering rich stews and elaborate banquets, feasts for kings and caliphs that lasted weeks on end. In other words, food. Food, glorious food. Food that we never heard of, or very rarely thought of. Food and recipes that influenced the European medieval cuisine, and to this day we find echoes of them in recipes across the world, without exaggeration, from India to South America. And for this reason, I have invited on today's episode Professor Daniel Newman, an academic from Durham University specializing in Arabic literature, to talk to us about the medieval Arab cuisine. He is also known for his blog Eat Like a Sultan, where he brings the medieval recipes to our modern world with some mouth-watering creations. And so Professor Newman shares with us his unique insight of a rich and wonderful world. This was such a fun interview, and I thoroughly enjoyed our chat with Professor Newman. He's such a passionate and knowledgeable man who loves sharing his wisdom with us. If I had such lecturers in my university time, then I would have had, doubtless, a lot better grades. So the first part of this interview is going to be this week, and then next week we're going to have part two. So sit back, relax, and enjoy part one of the medieval Arab cuisine interview. So without further ado, let's welcome Professor Daniel Newman. Thank you for coming to the Delicious Legacy, Daniel.
Thank you, Thomas. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I hope you we'll enjoy tonight's talk. We are talking obviously about food, ancient food recipes, history, and obviously archaeology, experimental archaeology. So we enjoy all the stuff. So hopefully we will have fun talking about medieval Arab Persian cuisine, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see where our adventure will take us today.
Sounds good.
Yeah, before we start, a bit of an intro about you. What are you doing? Who are you? What are you up to? And all that stuff, if you don't mind.
Uh-huh. No, of course not. Well, I'm currently attached to Durham University, where I'm the professor of Arabic. And my research covers a number of areas, the two main ones being Arabic geographical literature, travel writing, and food studies, more precisely the history of the Arab culinary tradition.
Mm-hmm. And how did you end up doing that?
Doing Arabic or doing the...
The food and the cuisine, the culinary adventure, let's say.
Right. Well, that's an interesting journey in itself. It grew out of work that I did on on medieval Islamic medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in Islamic medieval medicine, food plays an important role. It's part of this humoral tradition, just like in ancient Greece.
Yeah.
Food, of course, or medicine is viewed in what we can call, or what we today call, a very holistic perspective. And so food, what you eat and what you drink and when you do so, has an important effect on your health, on your mood, and so on and so forth. And so it was essentially a natural progression into the culinary tradition. And so this is now a fair number of years ago. But very soon afterwards, I thought it might be a nice idea to combine the practical with the theoretical.
Mm-hmm,
and to start cooking some of those things. And so my partner and I started experimenting, and that then led to a blog where I present these recreations of dishes, as well as provide some what I hope is interesting background information. And I have to say that the journey, not only has the journey been extremely pleasant and pleasurable, it has also had a very practical consequence, and that is that often the culinary texts, and perhaps we'll have occasion to talk about this later on, but
yeah,
often the culinary recipes are a little bit short on the detail, so to speak. And by cooking them and by experimenting, I actually obtained a much better insight sometimes into how the recipes worked, because the recipes were written for the most part for people who already knew how to cook.
Mm.
And it's a little bit like today, if a chef writes a recipe for another chef, it's a bit like a chemist writing something for another chemist. You assume certain things. You assume that the other person knows that you put this ingredient before the other one. And so by experimenting, it actually gave me a wonderful insight into the subject. And often when something was unclear in the recipe, by cooking it, it became suddenly very clear what the author intended. But, you know, it's an extremely fun thing and a very enriching aspect of my academic work.
Brilliant. That sounds already very fascinating. And I can't wait to hear more about it, of course. So basically, your personal project is called Medieval Arab Cooking, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. You have an Instagram account and you have a blog. Do you do any events as well?
Yes. For instance, a couple of years ago, I organized a medieval banquet in Qatar.
Uh-huh.
At the Museum of Islamic Art. And so I drew on recipes from a wide variety of cookery books from across the Muslim world, across the Mediterranean.
Mm.
And this was done in a modern kitchen at the restaurant of the Museum of Islamic Art, the Alain Ducasse restaurant. And that was a wonderful experience as well. And to the best of my knowledge, I think it's probably may well be the only such event to have taken place in the Arab world. And so it's a testament also to a growing interest in the subject everywhere, really.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the Arab cuisine, obviously, in general, and historical Arab cuisine, which is, I guess, is going to be very different to what we think now as Middle Eastern cuisine, but also in terms of the experimental archaeology as well, I think. And throughout the Mediterranean, I suppose, we have a huge area of influence from the Arabs. So I think from Spain all the way, mm-hmm. One side of the Mediterranean, North yeah. Africa, all of the Middle East, the Arab world, Persia, Iran, Iraq, what we call Iran, Iraq, and Turkey. And yeah, so it must be a huge area and must be a lot of different influences and dishes that you can find and explore in this vast region, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. There are a number of competing aspects, really. On the one hand, I mean, the variety is astounding, and it's one that never ceases to amaze. The Arab tradition, culinary tradition, in terms of the number of recipes, we're talking about over 4,000 recipes.
Wow.
And so for a number of centuries, nobody was writing cookery books except the Arabs.
Mm.
And so it's an immensely rich literature, the richest, actually. If we're talking about historical culinary tradition and historical works, textual resources, it's the richest. And in fact, it's only preceded by essentially the big Roman cookery book by Apicius.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you know, there was, of course, cooking before that, but the sources are very, very scarce indeed. There are no cookery books that have come down to us written by the Greeks, for instance. Yeah. There are references, but there's no cookery books. And so apart from this Latin work, for centuries we have nothing. And then all of a sudden we have this huge body of recipes that emerges fully formed. So there are many, many mysteries, delightful mysteries about this subject.
I see.
The first, that it should have occurred in that region. Secondly, that it appears it literally fully formed. And so the oldest cookery book already has hundreds of recipes. So this starts in about the 10th century, although the manuscript of that text is dated a few centuries later, from the 13th, actually. And so it continues in the 10th and then the 13th, 14th and 15th centuries.
Mm.
And then it stops. The third point is, of course, that, and now I'm returning to your point about the variety and the geographical area, is that we've got culinary resources that from the Western Mediterranean, so Muslim Spain, Al-Andalus, all the way to Iraq, or what is today Iraq.
Mm,
and yeah. On the one hand, there are a number of differences. On the other hand, it is also very interesting to note the number of similarities between the dishes. And of course, this also then can be linked to this very extensive trading network that existed. You know, today we often imagine that you had two separate worlds, the Christian world, the Muslim worlds, and never the twain shall meet, that kind of view. Whereas in reality, nothing could be further from the truth. There was a huge amount of exchange, of contact across the two areas. And of course, also within the Muslim world.
Yes.
And so you find, for instance, just like couscous, traveling west already probably the 12th century. In the 13th, 14th century, we already have recipes. And when an Ottoman traveler visits Egypt in the 17th century, he actually notices or remarks on the fact that couscous is one of the things that Egyptians eat the most. So on the one hand, a variety, but on the other hand, also exchanges between across the Muslim world.
Yeah.
And of course, that's part of the story. The other half of the story are then the exchanges to which you've also referred between the Arabic culinary tradition and Christian Europe, where you essentially have what we can call a pincer movement. On the one hand, there is an influence that takes place or that runs along more east through Italy, and of course Sicily, as you know,
yeah.
the Arabs, of course, were in Sicily for quite some time. So through Sicily and then Italy, and then we have another route, perhaps a more obvious one through, of course, Spain, the Iberian Peninsula.
Yeah.
Where we have a number of influences that filter through first to the Spanish, but then also go up north. And medieval European cuisine contains quite a few elements that we can trace back without much difficulty to the Arab tradition.
Indeed. Especially, I think, with the use of the spices. So all the spices coming from the East, they had to go through the Arab world and then to be exchanged and come to North Europe. And then North Europeans used a lot of spices. And of course, rice as well.
Today's episode is brought to you with the welcome support of Maltby & Creek, UK's leading Greek delicatessen, supplier and distributor of premium Greek produce. Be it wine, herbs, cheeses or olive oil, from all over the wild corners of Greece, and working directly with small artisan producers. If you want to try some amazing traditional meats from Greece, preserved meats, why don't you get some Vavourakis organic smoked tsiklino from Maltby & Creek? So this is preserved and smoked pork in olive oil, and they follow a traditional Cretan recipe for it, which is really old. And the meat is smoked using olive wood, and it's flavored with pepper and cumin. So this is kind of, this is a kind of meat and the kind of preservation techniques that go a long, long way to the past. And it has some relation to our episode today. Or you can try the organic Cretan sausages with cumin and vinegar. Again, another old Cretan recipe with roots to the Byzantine Empire. Whatever you need, Maltby & Creek has you covered. You can shop online and have the exquisite goods delivered to your doorstep across the UK, or you can visit the shop at Arch 17 Apollo Business Park, Lucy Way, SE16 4ET, Bermondsey, London. Maltby & Creek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. And, of course, for all you dear listeners, Maltby & Creek has an amazing discount of 15% off your next purchase. So go online, go to the website and type maltbyandgreek.com/delicious and you get 15% discount at the checkout.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And of course, rice as well.
Yes, yes, indeed. The spices, you know, things like, ginger, things like coriander. The use of rose water, for instance, is also something that's very Arab and that was very popular in Western Europe. Rice is an interesting one, though. Because although today in the Arab world, at least in the East, in the Near East, rice is a very frequently encountered ingredient. In some areas, it is an absolute staple. You know, places like the Gulf, for instance, where rice is eaten almost daily. In other areas, however, for instance, in North Africa, rice is eaten with much less frequency. And the same was true, incidentally, in Muslim Spain. The reason being, and this is borne out, incidentally, by the cookery books, by the recipes, the reason being a very obvious one. And that is that in Muslim Spain, there was a very limited rice production. And so rice was essentially restricted to those areas, particularly around Valencia and so on, where rice was grown, which explains why to this day in North Africa, it's either couscous or bread. Bread is the big thing. So there, North Africa, so Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, I don't think we can call those rice countries even today, although, of course, people do eat rice. But so that's one very interesting difference. Another one is fish, interestingly enough. Fish in the Near East, there aren't really that many fish dishes because fish was considered less favorably than meat. Meat was king, of course. And so fish was not something that would appear in great quantities at the tables of the elite. In the Western Mediterranean, so North Africa and Muslim Spain, there we find quite a few recipes that that contain fish. And in one case, we even have recipes for tuna, the what I believe to be the oldest recipes, actually, for tuna.
Right. Okay. Yeah. What's the recipe? What exactly are the details from the recipe?
It's they use both fresh and dried, but it's essentially a fish cooked with a variety of spices.
Right,
and then you would have eaten that with bread, of course.
Right. So if we go to, let's say, the area of what was what is now Iran and Iraq, and like this kind of Persian influence of the Arab world, what's happening in that area around the 10th century AD then? What's the general geopolitical situation, which and how that influences, what do we know from that area about the food and the recipes and the books that they come out from there?
Right, yeah. So the 10th century, so we're in the Abbasid Caliphate, which succeeded the Umayyads, who in turn, of course, succeeded, in a manner of speaking, the Sassanids, the Persian dynasty of the Sassanids. And so the 10th century was an interesting period because it's also in that century that we have the emergence of a Persian dynasty, the Buyids, who actually take Baghdad at some point. But when we talk about the influence of the Persians, that actually started a great deal earlier.
I see.
And in fact, it goes back to the very beginning of the Arab culinary tradition. In fact, the Persian influence goes some way towards explaining why this tradition arrived on the scene, burst onto the scene, fully formed.
Mm-hmm.
So the main influences, very, very briefly.
Of course.
In terms of recipes, in terms of dishes and flavors and so on, I think what probably springs to mind for me are things like stews from the Persians, the sweet and sour, sweet meats, and of course also the culinary, or I should perhaps say gourmet, gastronomical culture of the banquets and culinary extravagance and opulence, the emphasis on meat. That is something that came from Persia through the Sassanids.
Right.
And of course, the next question is, well, if there are no Persian cookery books available, how can we corroborate this kind of statement? Well, fortunately, there are a number of things that support this. There's a great deal of corroborative, albeit circumstantial evidence. The first very significant point here is the linguistic evidence. And so many of the dishes in the early Arabic culinary tradition have Persian names. And these are things like sigbaj, which is a vinegar stew. Sigbaj, so sig is the Persian word for vinegar. And baj is the Middle Persian word for stew, so vinegar stew. They some of the ingredients appear in their Persian form rather than the Arabic form. What else? There are references in the early cookery books, and even slightly later, it has to be said, to Persian history, and especially the Sassanids. References to historical events, people, you know, like the great Anushirwan, the Khosrow, the king. And then we also are fortunate, although there's no cookery books, there are a few textual sources that tell us a little bit about Sassanid food. And one such source is a very short little tale about the king and his page. And it's a very short story about a king essentially interviewing a young man that wants to be his page. And the king wants to make sure that this young man knows all the right things about what is appropriate for civilized society, so to speak. And one of the areas on which the boy is questioned is food. And so he's asked, for instance, what are the finest meats? What are the finest dishes? What is the best wine? And so on and so forth. And so here we get a little bit of an insight. Once again, we have references to sweets, for instance, which occur in their Persian form, and which we can find already in the Arabic books later on, things like lauzinaj and jauzinaj, which are respectively almond and walnut sweets, lauzinaj being a kind of an ancestor to marzipan, but also some very scant, unfortunately, references to how the dish or dishes that the young man believes to be of the highest quality should be prepared. And so, for instance, he talks about a two-month-old kid goat that has been nourished with its mother's milk and that of a cow. Imagine the sophistication. So they even, it's kind of half and half milk combo that they would feed the little animal. And then the meat would be rubbed with olive juice.
Right.
And then cooked in a meat broth and eaten with sugar and candy. You can immediately sense the kind of sweet and sour, so this use of sugar with meat and so on is something that we also find in the Arab tradition. They were great lovers, for instance, of fruit stews. And, of course, we find the same thing. This is one of these main influences on medieval Christian Europe, where they had this blanc-manger, which is essentially a rice pudding with meat, with chicken.
Yeah.
Again, that's sweet and sour, which has a direct ancestor in the Arab tradition, which in turn goes back to a Persian tradition. And who knows where the Persians got it? Because I think one of the things that is so fascinating about food history and food studies, of course, is that you never know where it ends, nor is that particularly important. I think it's all about the journey. It's about contacts and
For sure.
And as people travel, they take with them their tastes and flavors, and then they marry them with new ones. And so it's something that ties us to our roots, but at the same time, it's also something that allows us to connect with other people. And I think that that's probably what I appreciate the most, and what I find the most enriching about studying the history of food.
I couldn't agree more with you, to be honest. I think that's the important thing, that we make connections with other people and with other cultures through food. And this is, this is really fascinating. And as you say, the journey too. And I suppose talking about the sweet element, so I guess they used sugar But do you think is that it was that the fact that it was expensive and they could show off, like the kings and the higher classes, that look, we can use sugar and we are rich, or it was something that it was more to do with the taste, that it was they were fascinated with the sweet and sour combination, as I suppose other cultures do.
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. Sugar, of course, came after another very popular sweetener, honey, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right in saying that sugar was more expensive. And so what's important here is that when we look at the body of literature of the cookery books, most of them reveal the cuisine of the elite.
Yeah.
And you rightly pointed out sugar being more expensive has a higher incidence in those recipes than it would have done amongst the general population, so to speak, who would have had honey. Also, sugar had the support of physicians. That's another element
that's
important.
Yeah.
But the sugar, if we're talking about influences, sugar, of course, is also, I mean, one cannot imagine cuisines in European cuisines today without sugar. In fact, cuisines in most places in the world. But it's worth bearing in mind, of course, that sugar, too, traveled with the Arabs and who introduced it. So sugar is an important sweetener, but there's still many of the dishes also rely on honey. So honey never really fell out of favor. And so it's perhaps ironic that today, of course, you know, where we're more health conscious, you know, sugar has become the devil, has become the devil's spice.
Indeed.
And we now, you know, it has to be natural. And so we've gone back to honey. So we've come full circle, because obviously in ancient Mesopotamia, there was no sugar. And so it was only honey.
Yeah.
And so we've now arrived back in a way to that period. The difference being that we have access to ingredients, but we choose not to use them, which isn't a bad thing necessarily, of course.
Mm, indeed, yeah. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next week for part two of the interview. In the meantime, go on Spotify, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts from, and please leave a nice review and share the podcast with your friends and other foodie people. Thank you once again for listening to the Delicious Legacy podcast. I love to hear your thoughts and responses, so please head over on Twitter and tell me what you think. You can follow the podcast at The Delicious Legacy, all one word. Or join me on Patreon, where you can put The Delicious Legacy again, one word. And that's Patreon, Patreon.com/ The Delicious Legacy. Or Google Patreon and The Delicious Legacy podcast. This podcast can only keep going with the generous support of our subscribers on Patreon. You guys keep me running, you help me cover my costs, and allow me to dedicate more time researching each episode. I want to thank all of my subscribers for helping so far to create this series. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider going to Patreon and type The Delicious Legacy Podcast and contribute something and keep this podcast running. Thanks for listening. All the best. Over and out.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.